Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome coming out with another episode of Inside Curling. Before we start the show, we're very pleased to let everybody know that we are now part of the Sportsnet family. Kevin and Warren have been fantastic. Obviously, the people love it, and it's been growing exponentially. And we've always talked about how can we make this really big. And, of course, Kevin, Sportsnet is the key to all of this.
Well, yes. And, well, for me, I guess we're new to the Sportsnet podcast family, but I feel like I've been part of the family at Sportsnet now for, I guess it's got to be almost 7 years now. So it's been a fantastic 7 years with Sportsnet, and now to be able to continue on and expand into the podcast world is really exciting. And it's an exciting time for curling with the Olympics on the horizon. And the growth of this Inside Curling podcast has been incredible. And of course, going forward with Sportsnet will be really, really exciting.
So now, Warren, we've got this deal with Sportsnet. Don't make any mistakes, Kevin. We don't want to blow the deal, okay? And Kev, you and I were talking when this came together a few days ago that it came into reality. You and I were both saying, how now is Warren possibly going to answer 10,000 emails a week? Warren, are you nervous? Because you got a lot of work ahead of you. But what a great thing for us, Warren.
Well, I hope we have that problem. Of course, Rod Paulson helps us with a lot of that as well. So we hope that's going to be the issue going forward. And certainly we'd like to extend a thank you to Sportsnet for having the foresight to see where this whole thing could be going. And we think it will go. And the whole podcast world and the sport of curling is up and running. And we think it's going to be phenomenal going forward.
All right. Everyone stay sharp. Kev, don't make any mistakes. You know, I'll be fine. Let's roll out another show, boys. Here we go.
Last rock, eighth end, up by two.
I don't think I'm white.
I don't think you are either.
Oh.
It's clean. Don't kill it, Benny.
Line's really good. Line's good. Right on the button, guys. Right
here. Last stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The sweepers are watching it. Fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion. Cuts him to one. He will win his final Grand Slam, taking the Players' Championship. Talk about putting an exclamation mark at the end of a career. All he had to do was cut him down. Kevin Martin can celebrate. He is a champion.
Well, there you have it. Kev, we got a new intro. You were really, really good.
A long time ago. Yeah, exactly. 7 years ago, but that was sure exciting. The Players' Championship back in 2014, and I believe that was in Summerside, PEI.
Warren, was this all made up, or was Kevin the guy?
Kevin was the guy. He's been the front center of the sport pretty much for the last 20 years up until his retirement, so not surprised.
Both of you are in the World Curling Hall of Fame, so we need your take and your opinion, Kevin, about the Briars so far. Some teams are winning that maybe weren't supposed to, and some are losing that weren't supposed to. What say you, Martin, about it?
We talked a couple of podcasts ago about the field having, you know, 10, 11, 12 really good curling teams in it. And as we sit here on Tuesday morning taping the show, there are 12 teams in the hunt for the playoffs. Amazing. A real fight at the top. And you know, Kevin Cooey's pulling himself away from the field a little bit, but everybody else, wow, it is going to be a battle coming into the weekend. I really look forward to it.
What about you, Warren? What's your take on what's happened so far?
Things have more or less unfolded as I would have predicted. There's sort of three divisions or three sections that you can kind of look at. There's the front-running teams, the nine off the Canadian team ranking system. They're pretty much there, 1 to 9. And then there's four teams that are kind of just behind them, which would be probably Quebec, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and BC. A couple of those teams have been doing really well. On any given day, they could beat any one of those top nine teams. And then on the bottom side of the scale, there's five teams there that probably didn't have a lot of chance coming in and aren't doing all that well.
Kevin, there's some talk that no fans at the arena aren't going to change it too much for the high-performance teams. But will it take away the nerves, Kev, of guys who are underdogs in this thing? Would it be a little easier for them? I can only imagine back in the day stepping onto the ice, Kevin, with 15,000 people.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Jimmy, because most of the games that I would have played since way back in 1991 at the first Briar was in front of a crowd, and I just love a crowd. When you make a big shot, the rock stops after an angle raise or a double or something, and the crowd roars. It's just so important to an athlete, and you might be right. Maybe it's it'll get rid of some of the butterflies, but I think every athlete, not just curling, but any athlete, if you can compete in front of a big crowd, that's what you want. You know, just to hear that roar of the crowd is just a wonderful thing.
Do you think it makes teams who are nervous, Warren, is it going to make them less nervous? Or does it give an advantage to the front runners anyways with no crowds?
I think it's probably going to give the edge to the front runners for the most part without the crowds, because I think the first time you go into a building and there's a big crowd there, it's just it's a feeling like, as Kevin suggests, you can't explain. And a crowd always, particularly with these Briar events, there's electricity in the building. And I can always remember when we did the first Briar in Calgary in the big building in 1997 in the Saddle Dome. Mm-hmm. And talking to Libby Raines, who was the manager of the day of the Saddle Dome, after it, she says, there's never been an event in the building like this except the Olympics. Our staff has suggested that the electricity that was generated by the curling fans was only second to the Olympics. And I always remember that, and I think that's pretty much sums it up. There's an electricity in the building with the fans and their cheering.
I never thought they'd be able to pull it off with the pandemic, but the Scotties happened last week, and we're in the middle of the Briar right now. You can't talk about curling and the competition unless you talk about the ice. Kevin, you are going to give us your take on the condition of the ice over the last couple of weeks. Warren, is it time to set a clock for each end? You've always been a big advocate of trying to shorten up the game, and we want to get your word on that. The Women's World's going to be played in Calgary, and what about the World's Mixed Doubles? What's going to happen with that? Lots of talk this week, and certainly on our Facebook page, about television ratings. They were down, Warren, for the Scotties, and I expect they're down for the first part of the Briar. Why is that? Is it curling alone that's suffering from this, or is it sports altogether? We got a guest, Kevin. Maybe we can get the real story on you, Martin, okay? Your longtime lead, Donnie Bartlett, is going to join us. He's now coaching Team Botcher. Of course, he won with you, Kevin. He had a long career. Were you guys 89, 1990, right through to 2005, Kevin?
Yeah, a long time with Donnie B, and that he would have some stories, but he's a true gentleman. He'll keep the ones that he shouldn't tell to himself, I hope, but I look forward to hearing all about it from Donnie B. He's a class individual and obviously one of the best curlers ever, but he's proven himself to be a fantastic coach as well, so we'll have some fun with Donnie B.
Yeah, one of the guys who was such a huge part of Curling Worm when you were running it, you, of course, have something to say to Don.
Well, Don's always been a great guy to chat with at any time you run into him, always friendly, always personable, and I always, with Kevin's team, with the two Dons, Don Bartlett and Don Walchuk, and always had lots of fun with both those guys.
Well, same guys, Don Walchuk and Don Bartlett, Kevin. They never did listen to you about having to go back to the hotel right after the draws. They showed up in the patch, baby. Okay. and of course, I love those guys. They were great in there. The Briar Patch is a very unique thing to the Briar. There's a history to it, and I had the greatest 10 to 12 years of my life, doing that gig for 10 days in the patch, and we're going to talk about that as well today. So looking forward to that. Kev, let's get right to you now. Let's talk about the ice over the last couple of weeks.
I do want to talk about this, because you heard during the Scotties that the conditions got a little bit flat, maybe around the 8th end, 7th end, and very difficult to draw the button the last couple of events during the Scotties. But here at the Briar, it's been much, much better. Very good, actually. And that's indicative of Monday. We're taping on Tuesday. Monday afternoon, Brad Jacobs threw an outturn draw. I know everybody at home, of course, times every rock like me. And his draw was 14.4 seconds, hog to hog, right to the freeze. That night, Matt Dunstone throws draw to win at 14.7 seconds. So the ice has been very consistent, somewhere between 14.5 to 15, hog to hog to the button at the Briar. So I want to talk about the difference and why. So let's get a little technical here. So when it comes to flooding the ice before an event, there's an RO system, reverse osmosis system, that's used. And you can imagine that you're removing the impurities out of the water as it runs through the system onto the ice. If you flood at too fast of a rate. And stop me if it gets too confusing, but if you come through the system too quick, it won't remove all the impurities. And what happened at the Scotties, I was talking to one of the guys, is that the water was just coming too soon. They flooded too quickly and ended up getting impurities in the water, the flood water. Mm-hmm. And then for the Brier, of course, realizing this, they flooded much slower and kept the parts per million right down to almost zero. And therefore, you have a firmer surface. And what happens when you get impurities in the ice is that you can use pure water to pebble with, right? So that's what people are going to think. Well, just pebble with pure water, be no problem. But underneath, you've got the impurities in the body of the water, of the ice. And what happens with impurities, they always go from an area of high concentration and they migrate into an area of low concentration, which of course, in this case, would be the pebble. So once that sludge, that impurities floats up, migrates up into the pebble, you can imagine that the pebble's not as hard and therefore it's going to wear much quicker and there and it gets kind of slippery on top, kind of greasy, and then the rocks will take off and they just kind of die. And that's what was happening in the Scotties. And you've noticed the Brier, because the impurities aren't there, the ice is staying very crisp. And even in the 11th end, extra ends at 14.5, 14.7 can get you the T-line. So a very nice surface in the Brier, and it will be going forward as well. So fantastic job by the ice makers.
Yeah, talk about that for a second, Kevin. When we see it on TV, there's four sheets this year. Sometimes there's more sheets. Are they always all consistent, Kevin? Does it make a difference which sheet you curl on as you go through the week?
They're pretty consistent, but every sheet will certainly have its own slant or its own breaking points will be a little different, but for the most part, an ice maker, say in this case Greg Owosko, he's a fantastic ice maker, his ice tends to be a little bit straighter and not that great big bend that a Mark Shurik gets. Mark Shurik makes the ice for the Grand Slam of curling, and he always has more late finish, more snap at the end. So every ice maker has their own characteristics of how they make the ice. But from sheet to sheet, Jimmy, it's pretty consistent across the board. Absolutely.
Warren, when we talk about the ice, I know over the years you ran these events for many, many years. And I remember you telling me one of the biggest things you're stressed out about is that there won't be a big problem with the ice away from the ice maker. Was there one year, Warren, where stuff fell out of the ceiling onto the sheets?
Yes, that was the 2001 Brier in Ottawa. And that is always a concern, particularly in an older building, that things can fall from the rafters, and often what they do prior to starting to put in the ice is they try to clean that whole area up as best they can before they start, but that's always a concern. The ice plant and the power is a concern, and I think it was the 1999 Brier in Edmonton. One of the automatic thermostats in the building shut off about 3 o'clock in the morning, and when the ice crew came into the building at about 6 a.m., they were within an hour probably of would have lost the ice. So those are always things that are a worry, and the ice technicians have to keep a constant eye 24 hours a day on monitoring what is happening with everything in those buildings. So it's always tense.
Kevin, if the ice conditions do change from day to day, who do you see that will be able to adapt to that better than other teams in this year's Brier?
You know, the Wind Sports Center in Calgary is such a modern and gorgeous building. I don't foresee that happening at all, actually. I think the ice is going to be fantastic right to the end. You've got the top ice crew. They've got 8 ice makers, and they're all terrific at their job. So I'm not very worried about that. Obviously, experience if things change a little bit. But I want to tell you one quick story. The 97 Worlds, talking about ice conditions, and that was in Bern, Switzerland, and the building didn't have walls at either end. Just wide open, just air. So you can imagine lots of birds flying through the building, and you can imagine stuff that was falling from them, and that was right onto the ice, and the ice makers are kind of pulling their hair out because it tends to be a little bit warm, that stuff that's falling. And of course,
you're not talking feathers here either, are you?
We're not talking feathers. So that was a fun world in Bern 1997.
Could you imagine the poor ice maker, Warren, going, okay, I think we got this handle. What could possibly go wrong now?
Well, that building that Kevin's referring to, I, interestingly enough, played in it in the World Championship in 1974, and it's open at both ends, so the sun shines through it. It's all glass. And you could have some amazing things taking place in the afternoon when the ice got a little warm from the sun versus what was happening in the evening. So that was the old days.
I can't imagine the poor ice makers sitting there going, we never thought a bunch of birds were going to come in and drop a deuce on all the sheets. Warren, let's talk about, you've always been a strong advocate for shortening the games, and you want to talk about maybe it's time to put the clock on each end and not just for the game itself.
Well, interesting, I think, if we look at what's been going on in Calgary at start of the week, and this was partly because I think they were trying to get their legs again, get the feel under them, but maybe in some instances they were just trying to bank time as well. So you saw a number of games where the teams pretty much ran the rucks up and down for two ends, and of course that's not uncommon in many cases as we get into the year that they'll do that to bank time for later in the game. So Kevin and I have talked about this, and I've been a proponent of saying, is it maybe time that we looked at allotting so much time per end and not giving you time for the entire game so that we ensure that that type of thing doesn't happen? And I guess I also, again, look back, if that's what's happening in the first two ends of a 10-end game, maybe it is, again, time that those games became eight ends. But a thought and a conversation point.
What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, well, I'm all for shortening the game and just keeping it exciting for the fans. It's all about the fans. And so, yes, in this Scotties and Briar, you've seen teams that run it up and down. Because it's 10 ends, most games in the whole world of curling are 8 ends. So basically, you got these two extra ends to run them up and back and save time. But is that exciting for the fans? And I think there's a major problem with a 10-end game. I don't talk to any top curlers that want 10 ends. It's just not in existence. So if you tighten up the draw to the button time and then go to time per end, 8 ends, you know, you're really tightening it up. And, you know, the Gen Zers, they're not going to watch a 3-hour, 3-hour and 15-minute game. They're just not going to. Mm-hmm. So let's keep it down to 2 hours, 2 hours and 10 minutes to close it up. And that'd be a lot more appealing. So I think you're bang on, Warren, with time per end.
I watched, I watched Nova Scotia play on Monday night. Scott McDonald is the skip, and Paul Fleming has, you know, been a Briar mainstay for many years coming from the Maritimes. Both of those guys, Warren, got caught with too little time, and it certainly played in to the rocks that they had to toss. They were running to the other end to jump in the hack, and it certainly affected them. They're saying Scott McDonald's going to have a really hard time with, I guess he's a little deliberate, you guys, but he's going to have a difficult time with being under the clock or on the clock.
Well, I think if we look in the last few years, the guy that's always running the clock to the limit is Kevin Cooey. And he seems to somehow always manage to stay under it. But I think he's the guy that has the most problems. Wouldn't you agree, Kevin?
Yeah, he's notorious for running it right down to the last
the
5 seconds.
Let's go.
Yeah, Kevin, he'll always get it in. It doesn't matter what rule. He's a really smart guy. He can figure it out. But to make it per end, that would tighten up the game no matter what. And that's fantastic. Scott McDonald, I want to say something here. So I didn't really know Scott McDonald until we were in one of the Lupus bond spiels down in Minneapolis. And it's so much fun down there. And so we're taking some flies out in the baseball diamond. And so I don't have that good arm anymore. And so we're catching flies out in center field right back by the fence. And so I catch one, I throw it in, I get to about second base. Well, Scott catches one. He throws an absolute bullet to the plate. Like, are you kidding me? Scott McDonald, I don't know if everybody knows this, he has an absolute cannon of an arm. He must have played some really high-level ball as a youngster because it's impressive, you guys. Amazing arm in Scott McDonald.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either until I saw it.
I knew you had a rubber arm.
Yeah, that I do have a rubber arm. Yeah, but he has a rocket ship. Amazing.
The pistol. Yeah, good for him. Moving ahead, boys, let's talk about, Warren, let's talk about the Women's Worlds. They're going to be played in Calgary. I never thought they'd be able to pull off the Scotties or the Briar, but they're doing it, and it's not going to be a problem. This thing is going to, there hasn't been any incidents of COVID. They've got to do a number of protocols with isolating in the hotel, et cetera, you know, to temperature testing. Congratulations for them to pull this thing off. Talk about the World's Women's.
Well, that's great news, and we, of course, announced that we thought that was going to happen last week, and a day later it did, so congratulations to everybody who made that a reality, And I think it's going to be in the latter part of May as far as timing is concerned. The other event that hasn't been mentioned a lot yet is the World Mixed Doubles, which that's also an important one to have happening this year as well because of the Olympic rankings that are going to come out of it. And I've heard a little rumor that they're potentially looking at maybe that's going to go into Scotland at a later date, but they're still working and trying to find a site and location for that event to take place.
What do you say, Kevin, about this?
Well, you know, I sit on my deck and have a glass of wine, and sometimes a birdie comes and tells me stuff, and it's really cool. And you know, the bird came and told me about the Women's Worlds, and that bird was really right. And that same bird came by a couple days ago and mentioned the World Mixed Doubles. It might end up in the bubble too. I hadn't had only my first glass of wine, so I got to believe the bird again. So I sure hope it happens. There's has been no announcement, but that would be fantastic. You know, I'm just thinking about it for the teams, the ladies teams. Of course, we talked to Carrie Anderson and she played the Scotties. The next day she got home. She got to go home. But Let's talk about for a second here. If it's a men's team that wins the Brier and happens to be somebody who's really good at mixed doubles, you've got the Brier starting March 5th, going to the 14th. Then you get the Canadian mixed doubles, which that person or players on that team would be part of, starting on the 18th to the 25th. So they can't go home yet. Oh, but then the World Men's is up April 2nd. No time to go home between those events. And that goes till April 11th. And then you've got in the Grand Slam, you've got the Humpty's Champions Cup starting April 14th. Well, we know from talking to the ice makers, it's only 60 hours for them to get the ice ready between the two, so they can't go home then to the 18th. Princess Auto Players Championship, April 20th to the 25th. Oh, no time to go home there. So can you imagine from probably entering the bubble on the second or third day of March, the men's teams that win the Brier won't leave the bubble till the 26th day of April at the earliest.
Yikes.
Oh, wow. So isn't that amazing? Like, I'm so happy that the bubble event has happened. But can you imagine? That's quite a stay away from home for the men's teams that win the Brier. And a ton of games. I don't know, I didn't calculate how many curling games that would be, but it's just a lot.
But especially during that period of time when you get to be in two places, the curling rink and your hotel room. Think about that for that period of time.
You know, your personality, Kevin, and yours, Warren, I would say, well, if there are two guys that could handle these restrictions, it would be the two of you. I mean, you're fairly low key. I would go berserk. I would go absolutely bananas. And when I think of who would have trouble with it, Kevin, I think of Ben Hebert. You know, this guy's so social, so animated, loves to be around people. It's going to be really difficult for him.
Yeah, and it's not just him. There's quite a few characters that girl and that are high energy. It's hard to be more high energy than Ben Hebert. But there's lots of people like that. And you bet it's like caging an animal. Like after a while, they go, I gotta do something. So it's going to be interesting. It'll be fun to try to get somebody who does win this Brier on to hear all about this because I'm really interested. It's been nothing that's ever happened before in the history of our sport. And so it'll be really interesting to hear from the athletes, you know, how do you handle this amazing amount of time?
What would you do with your time, Warren? Are you a reader or anything? Can you play chess, backgammon, something? How would you spend your time, Warren, if you had to isolate, in your hotel?
Right now, I would be answering emails and answering questions on Facebook.
Well, back in the day, if you were a curler. You were around, Warren, before they even invented the typewriter. Never mind a computer. Say you were coaching the guys, Warren. What would you tell them under this, crazy circumstance?
Well, I think the key thing is you've got to try to find something to occupy your mind when you're away from the curling facility and, we'll probably set up a bit of a routine. And I think that's probably the secret to it all is to be able to set up a routine so you become familiar with things and things start to seem somewhat normal. I mean, same things we've all been doing over the last year with this COVID issue. We try to set up a routine to make our lives look as normal as they can under difficult circumstances.
You were instrumental and vital and the main guy behind the growth of curling. You've been involved in it your whole life. You got it into the Olympics. You got the Brier and the Scotties to huge crowds from nothing. And of course, the wall-to-wall television coverage that there is of all curling stuff now with the Grand Slam and Sportsnet, who's been doing this for a while. But it's been declining, Warren. Curling has had ebbs and flows, and maybe it's a little down right now. We do know this. The ratings for the Scotties was way down. And the Brier in their first week, I think, is down. Are we in trouble with this, Warren?
Well, there's an interesting phenomena going on, and I'll go back to the Scotties. In the opening weekend, I saw numbers in that one that said it was down about 17%, but the sort of shocking one was the Scotties final was off 30% of what it was the year before on the official rating numbers. But interesting enough, not to select curling out of the pack at this stage of the game, most of these sports, the big ones, have been facing the same phenomena, but no one seems to really be able to understand why that's happening when people are at home sitting in their living rooms and their rec rooms with probably not a lot of things to do. Why is the television numbers on these events and some of the big ones, hockey, basketball, off from what you would normally expect them? NFL Super Bowl was off. And so I haven't seen or heard anything yet that gives us an answer for that whole dilemma. But certainly it looks like the Scotties anyway. The final was not what we would have hoped it to be, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens this week if the Brier numbers follow suit or if, in fact, they do pick up as the week goes on.
I think it's totally ironic, Kevin. I just would have assumed with people stuck at home the majority of the time and not socializing, not getting out, not traveling, that everyone would be watching TV, especially live events.
Yeah, so ratings, how they work. Now, you know, I once again, you know, we've had Donnie, guy like Donnie B with all the big memory here, he'd correct me. But I think ratings go per minute, a certain amount of time in a minute, and you gauge the amount of people during that time, and it's every minute for the entire length of the show. So what I'm worried about when it comes to ratings, especially on events where the first two ends, you're just throwing it up and back, you lose a lot of viewership. Because, of course, everybody knows, oh, it's a blank, and then it's a blank. So if you do turn away at that time, only a certain percentage turn back to the game. And so I think that's a major problem, is the length of the game. And because of the length of the game, a lot of your first two, three, even four ends tend to be blanks. So that's a problem. I think it's a real problem in real life. So I'm going to be really interested when we get to the Grand Slams in April and with the eight end games, much tighter television to see what the numbers do. Because as we know, talking to Gen Zers, we've done it, Warren. We did it a lot in late December, early January, and they don't like the idea of these long, 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 long games. So I think tightening up could make a difference, and we'll see come mid-April if it does make a difference. I honestly believe it will.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I think a lot of it may have to do with the whole approach that we have today on providing events through television and the change that's probably coming to video streaming and how this is all going to work together and result in the end of things continuing much the same way as they were. Is it going to change a lot? I think, again, everything's going to become more condensed, and maybe that's part of the problem, is people just aren't prepared to sit and watch these things for 3 hours. I don't know. Very interesting topic, interesting discussion. I'm sure that's going to follow.
Well, you know, you bring up a great point, Warren, on the idea of streaming. So I've got three kids, and they vary in age quite a lot. But none of them, let me just make sure I'm right with that. Yeah, none of them have cable TV. They don't have it. It's not a thing. They stream everything. Mm. They're going to watch all these games, but it's not going to be on cable television. So I don't know, you know, around the whole country what age that is and which ones have cable, which ones don't. It's kind of funny. You talk to a kid and say, computer. Well, what's a computer? I have a phone. I have a phone. And of course, you say computer, and a guy my age thinks that's modern, and you know, and the young people, they just don't look at everything the same as us. And I think you're right, Warren. Streaming is becoming so popular in the younger ages, and then you know, the over 50-year-olds still have cable, and we watch it, you know, like we always have. You know, turn to the channel and watch the game, and then if maybe flip to an Oiler game and then flip to something else, and that's kind of the way, whereas the young people will be streaming it and they don't even have cable. So interesting discussion, and I know there's some really smart people, much smarter than me, behind the scenes that obviously are thinking about this and how to deal with it going down the road.
I guess the key thing is, over the next few years here, we're going to go through a changing world, and it's going to be a challenge, because how you approach people with communications, whether they're probably over 50 or under 50, is today very different. And the blending those two things together, particularly with things like video streaming, is going to be an interesting challenge. And like you say, Kevin, it's above our pay grade.
Warren and Kevin, when I think Canada and what makes me Canadian and one of the most popular events, or two of them that I think of that really talk about Canadiana, and it's the Grey Cup and certainly the Brier and the Scotties. And I've never felt more Canadian than when in late November when I do watch the Grey Cup, and now in March, you know, the end of February and March, watching our national championships in curling. The problem with the Grey Cup, quickly, is I've been to the cities where they have it. It's very convoluted. If you went in on a Wednesday to celebrate it, like a lot of people do, there's too much going on. You got to go to this night over here. This province is having a pub night. These guys are having a pancake breakfast. These guys are having a lunch. BC's doing this. And I think it harmed the Grey Cup. The Brier and the Scotties, Warren, and I'm sure you were a big part of this, has got it going on, man, when it comes to what, you know, socializing, which is a huge part of curling. And Warren, you got to give us a little history, because I got some stories. The patch was a brilliant idea because it's the only game in town when curling's on and everyone shows up there.
Well, we're going to talk about the patch, but you remember a couple of weeks ago, Jim, you sang a little song for us that you thought was the greatest Brier Patch song ever. So I thought it'd be probably good today if we started off this little segment with your favorite Brier Patch song.
Come on, make tracks, the Briars coming to Halifax. Call the shots, scream and cheer, I skipper over here. Draw the button, throw the card, hit the broom of your hurry heart. No key of Brier, it's a sure thing.
I love this, Warren.
No key of Brier, it's a sure thing.
You know what, you're bringing me back. I don't know if you remember this, Warren, but that song became so popular. We would play it like two or three times an hour. Some of the best Briars were down in the Maritimes. Got a little out of hand, Warren. I was a little hammered emceeing, and you walked in to see me standing on the middle of a table getting everyone to sing the Nokia Brier. It's a sure thing. And you came running at me, almost tackled me, going, Jim, there's a small liability issue here. If you're walking around tables and you fall, get the freak off the table, Jimmy. Talk about the history of the patch, Warren, and how it all started.
Yeah, well, back to that song again. That was, again, one of the great ones. And our own Rod Paulson actually wrote the lyrics to that song. So that's another little tidbit for our show. Yeah, Rod wrote the lyrics for the song.
No kidding.
Anyway, the Brier Patch goes back to 1982. And certainly the Brier, from its original happenings, I wasn't around for that, although you think I was. But certainly when I came into the scene, there was always some kind of a drinking facility, hospitality area that was associated with the Brier. But in 1982, the Brier was in Brandon, and the host committee there, led by Don Pottinger, decided that they were going to create a special room where the patrons of the Brier could go and enjoy themselves following the games. So I guess after a fair amount of deliberation, they decided to call this little area the Brier Patch. And some of you may remember that there was a kind of a nursery rhyme called The Soul of the South that was produced 100 years ago, that had Brier Bear and Brier Fox going to toss Brier Rabbit into the Brier Patch, spelt B-R-I-A-R, not B-R-I-E-R. And that was sort of the idea that they came up with when this name Patch was attached to the Brier. It was from that nursery rhyme. And so that was started in 1982 in Brandon, very small. It was a room that held about 500 people. And from there, the Brier went to Sudbury in 1983, and Sudbury actually put up a tent outside the arena, which was a very small arena. And this tent wasn't huge. It was about 1,500 people, but it was a bubble tent. And I'll always remember they had vacuum doors, so you could only get so many people through the door at one time as they were lining up outside.
Or it would collapse.
It collapsed, but it became very popular. And by the time we got into 84, again, a small building in Victoria, they turned the entire Victoria Curling Club, the whole ice area, into the patch. And as the Brier moved across the country, started to move into places. I remember in 1985 in Moncton, the whole convention center attached to the arena was pretty large. And that was the first attempt to creating a patch that had any size. I think a lot of things happened over time, too. If you go back to the old days with the Brier, the curling clubs in the area always were hosting something every night that the Brier was on. And you'd go from one club to the other and around and around and around and sort of the Brier Patch or the facility at the arena was not a big deal. But by the time we got to the late 90s, there became a little conflict between the patch and the curling clubs, because the curling clubs wanted the fans to go to their building and the Brier committee wanted the people to stay in a patch. So I can remember even there was a deal worked out for a period of time in the mid-90s where the curling clubs would now host a night in the patch versus trying to get people back to their club. But as the Brier grew, so did the Brier patch. And initially, when it all started, it was done by the host committee, but Labatt were the sponsor back in the day of the 80s. And by the time we got to about 88, 89, they saw this whole thing developing and they wanted to become more involved with it. So they brought in a professional who was working for them, and it was Your Show Productions, but Roger Powell was the key guy with them, and so he started operating the Brier Patch in the late 80s, mm-hmm. pretty much on behalf of Labatt's with the host committees, but he started directing the whole scene. Things changed a lot in 1994 with the association between Labatt and the Canadian Curling Association, and as a result, they were no longer paying for people like Roger Powell to be part of the whole thing. So in 1995 in Halifax, we hired Roger actually to begin to run the patch in a similar manner that he had with Labatt. And as a result of that and his professionalism, the thing continued to grow. And as we got into the bigger buildings, it got even bigger yet. Biggest, most successful patch ever that was held was, interesting enough, in Regina in 2006. And the other challenge that we always had with the patch was it was assume that if you had a ticket to the arena that you would automatically have a ticket to get into the Brier Patch. So it was very hard to bring in people from the outside. But as the thing grew and the costs grew, we're becoming more reliant upon, we got to get people in here, just not somebody coming in for a beer after the game if we're going to make ends meet. In 2006, we managed to convince the committee and everybody involved that the arena wasn't that big compared to the buildings we had been in. They were going to have to market the patch. So in 2006, we actually marketed the patch as a separate entity. It was sold as a separate ticket because we didn't think we'd have enough tickets in the building. Won't get into the details of that, but as a result, in Regina 2006, we had sold probably about 3,000 or 4,000 tickets, by my memory, that gave you strictly entrance to the patch and not the arena at all. The result was in 2006 in Regina, that patch on three occasions had over 8,000 people in it. And it was, as you may remember, Jim, it was just unbelievable as to what was going on there. But we also had to invest a lot of money to make that whole thing happen. I remember we had Blue Rodeo for the opening night, and it was huge. Patch in Regina 2006 was very successful, most successful ever. We went into Hamilton 2007. It wasn't possible to continue with the same approach. We just didn't have the size in the building. And Winnipeg in 2008, we tried a similar approach. But by that time, we were getting some restrictions put on us by management with regard to what we could spend on the patch because people were nervous about it. And we went in there. We took quite a gamble. We brought in Burton Cummings for the opening night, and I think $100,000 was the cost of that act.
Yikes.
It didn't quite perform as we had expected. The patch still did okay, but as a result, there started to be more fingers coming into how we were running the patch, and cuts started to happen. And unfortunately, in my opinion, because of what happened from that day forward, the patch started to go downhill because the money wasn't being spent to make it what it was. And while it still exists today, it never is or will again be like it was back in around 2005, 2006, back in the glory days.
Kev, I don't know. You didn't allow your players to go to the patch until you lost or you won. Or so you think, Kevin.
I think that's probably more the truth of it. So you think.
Yeah. I've got some phenomenal stories, okay, about the Brier Patch. I've never seen anything like it when I got involved. And I was there, Warren, in all those years.
It was a great idea in 2006. Bernadette McIntyre and her committee came up with the idea of Party Gras. And Party Gras was maybe something that should have been hung on to and taken from patch to patch. But that was the theme of it. And the whole city was just behind that. It was unbelievable, phenomenal. You remember what it was like. It was just crazy.
Yes, of course. Yeah. We got to go to break, but before we do, because I could talk for hours about this, but my favorite was, there were 5,000 or 6,000 people in this patch that year, one of these years. And, you had to have a camera and big screens and everything to see it. So I had a guy follow me around. I jumped up after one of the draws. That's where we filled in a bunch of time with the emceeing duties. And I was standing at the front of the room. It was huge, because it held thousands of people. And a guy is walking up the middle. You always had these huge center aisles, right? With that right down the middle of the patch. And a guy's walking up from the very back. Crowd's starting to laugh. I'm looking around and I'm going, what's going on here? And as this guy gets closer and closer to me, people are laughing more and more and more. And he walks straight up. He's got a beautiful, three-piece suit on, looking great. And And by the time he just keeps coming right at me, and I'm going, what the freak is going on here? And when he gets up to me, he's standing straight in front of me, and people are absolutely going bananas. And he shakes my hand. I'm going, what's up, Scooter? And he goes, I just wanted to say hello. Nice to meet you, Jim. I'm having a lot of fun. Great job. And he turns around, okay? And he is completely buck naked on the back of the... He had just pasted, Kevin, the front of this suit onto his body. And he was... I'm talking the package, everything was showing. He turned around and walked away. And it was just absolutely the funniest thing I'd ever seen. The patch is great. The best fans in the world, curling fans, they come in to have fun. So we got to get to break. When we come back, we've got our special guest, Kevin, your longtime lead. We're going to talk to Don Barton. Well, that knocking at the door, okay, someone's trying to get into the show here, Warren and Kevin, and really been looking forward to this, our guest. You know, Kevin, behind every great skip, there's a better lead, right, Kev?
That's true.
And behind every great team, there's a better coach, man, and we're really looking forward to this guest. Silver at the Worlds, silver at the Olympics, gold medal at the Brier in 91 and 97. And he curled with you, Kevin, from 1989 to 2005, all the way from originally from Gander, Newfoundland. Would you please welcome Don Bartlett? How are you, bye? What's going on, Don?
Robert Ing, bye. I'm doing real good.
Okay. You know what I'd like to do first, Donnie, is I've kissed the cod, okay? And the Newfoundland tradition, of course, you got to kiss the cod. And I don't think Kevin and Warren have ever done that. So I think we should make them kiss the cod.
I've kissed the cod.
Warren's kissed the cod.
And I've kissed the cod as well.
Oh, there we go.
Lovely.
Excuse me. You know, I love everyone from Newfoundland, Donnie, but I hate that tradition. I didn't like that the first time they made me kiss the cod. Donnie, how's it going? You're coaching. We're doing this in the middle of the Brier course. And thanks a lot for coming on. We know you're busy. And you're coaching Team Botcher. How are you doing so far? Give us your take on your team.
Well, we're 3-1 so far, and we're trending the right way. The last game, the boys played really well, really against Madaw. Obviously, one of the best ever. And I'm stressed this year for some reason. Last year, it was stress-free, nerves, but not much stress. This year, I'm stressed. I think I care too much about the boys winning, and it's sort of stressing me out a little bit. But I'm hoping them well.
Tell us what it's about, Don. This year, of course, is the pandemic. There's no fans. Explain to us what it's like. I mean, you curled for many, many years, and you curled at big events with crowds of 15 to 20,000, but not this year. What's it like, Don?
I think the boys are getting used to it. I don't think it would bother me if I was curling, because you know, we've played big games in big arenas and in front of 50 people, too. So you get used to your surroundings, and... I think the boys are adjusting well. It's a little different that, you know, there's great shots being made and no crowd noise. That's the only different part, I think.
You curled for many years before we bring in Kevin and Warren, because we got lots we want to talk to you about. You curled for many years with Kevin. Tell us, first of all, how that all came together.
Well, I think you got your dates a little bit wrong.
Told you, Jimmy, that Donnie's really good with all the numbers. So here we go.
I got him from Kevin, so don't blame me, okay?
Yeah, no. Kevin's close on his stats, but he's off a little bit sometimes.
Yeah.
1990 was our first year together. So I knew whoever won the 91 Brier was going to be the Olympic team. And surprising to me, Kevin didn't know that until after the game when we won the Brier in 91. I thought he knew, but he had no idea, I guess. But so I wanted to get on. I was skipping at the time, and I knew I wasn't going to win skipping. I couldn't draw. You put more than two in the house, and I had to draw against two or three. I'm dead. Too nervous. I'm always looking for the one to hit.
Right.
So I knew whoever won in 91 would be the Olympic team, and that's why I joined up with Kevin. His lead moved away, and Kay Park and I talked, and they welcomed me to the team.
Were you part of that team where you guys got ice from the medical room so you could pour it into your drinks and lied that it was for someone's swollen ankle? Was that, were you had to be part of that?
That was a story I didn't know. I didn't know that story. I didn't, like, Walchuk went away for a while and I came back with ice. I had no, I'm a beer drinker, so it didn't affect me. But yeah, they came back with a pile of ice, and I didn't really hear the story until I listened to it on your show.
I love that. So it's one of my favorite stories. It gave me an idea, you know, down the road. Talk about your days with Kevin before we get into some other stuff. Donnie, we want to know, everyone loves Kevin. He's been named, you know, the number one curler in the world. He's in the Hall of Fame. But we want to know, because he can be cranky a little bit, Donnie, okay, once in a while.
No, no.
Yeah, careful, guys.
Give us some highlights of those days that you curled with Kevin.
Well, early on, he you couldn't tell him much, that's for sure. After about 3 or 4 years, he was really, really easy to get along with. I mean, if you did something wrong, and we all knew when we did things wrong, then, you know, he would give you grief, but not much grief. He would give you a stare or something like that. But like I say, the first couple, 3 years, Cape Rock and I knew the game a little bit better than Kevin did. And Kevin didn't think we did, maybe sometimes. But but after the first 3 or 4 years, there weren't very many issues. If you did your work and put your time in, did lots of practicing, Kevin didn't have any issues. And, you know, we all tried our best. That's all you can do. Sometimes you can't, you don't perform. As long as you put in your time, did your best, Kevin was pretty happy, I thought.
You know, Newfoundland's been on the map for a long time in curling. Take us back to your day, Donnie. What was it like back then? Were they under the radar back in your day, or even before that? When did it get really big in Newfoundland?
I only spent 1 year curling in Newfoundland. I think I was 13. And then when I was 14, I moved to Alberta. I think Mark Knowsley made the playoffs 1 year. And then after that, they got a little bit better, and then they got worse again. And then, of course, now with Guju, I mean, he's the best curler in the world right now. So hopefully that turns into good curling for the curlers behind him. And if anybody's from Newfoundland that's a young curler listening to this thing, keep going there. Keep getting your ass handed to you. But after 5 to 10 years, and if you practice a lot, you'll learn, and then you'll be the next Guju, hopefully.
There's an ongoing debate. The format has changed over the years with the amount of teams that are in. We've got the split pools and some debating about whether all the provinces should be involved or do we do a different thing. I'm sure you've heard some of that, Donnie. What's your take on it now, the way the Briar was, compared to when it used to be, first of all, with all the teams? And what are your thoughts on do we have a team from every province or not going ahead?
You want to see good curling, but you have to appease everybody. I mean, the fans are a big part of our sport, and a lot of the fans, they want to see every province. So I think we can do both. I think, you know, there are some provinces that struggle most times at the Briar, but it's part of Canadiana. It's having all the provinces there. As long as you get your top five, six men's teams at the Briar, I have no issue whatsoever of having every province represented, all the territories. As long as you get your best teams in.
Yeah, I think you're right, Donnie. I think that's really important to make sure that you cover the top teams so that young players coming up that are really quite good but unfortunately live in a province where there's 3 or 4 other really good older teams, they need to have the opportunity to grow. And that's where I think the old way of doing it really held some players back. One of them, of course, now a 4-time champion, Kevin Cooey. He could have been at many, many Briars, but unfortunately where he lived, he just didn't have much chance until you know, he had the opportunity in 2010. So you're right. I think it's important that we get the top teams a chance so that the young ones can develop so you can become the next Kevin Cooey, Brad Guju, you name it.
It's a challenge, but I think there's another thing we have to consider as well. Somebody asked me a question yesterday on the Facebook page of the young teams. He really liked watching the young teams that were coming up, the up-and-comers. And I said, well, unfortunately, the majority of up-and-comers are in the Canadian team ranking system list 10 to 20. And because of where they live, you probably aren't going to see them playing in a Briar under this current format for quite a while. So I think that's another challenge that we have to face going forward. And a lot of discussion about this. What the real answer to it is, I'm not sure yet, but I think something different has to start to happen in the next few years. But we got to be concerned about those young up-and-comers who simply aren't getting a chance to play until they're probably in their late 20s.
Well, one thing that's for certain, Warren, is when you put this out on the Facebook group, there's a lot of comments both ways. It's not clear.
No, it's not clear.
How to go forward, but you're right. We need to worry about the young ones. It's always been, well, I know Don and I talked about this at length over the last 20 years, is worrying about the young curlers coming up because we lose too many of them before they can get to be good. And that's always been a concern of all of ours. And so you're right, Warren. We do need to, more than anything, worry about our young players coming up.
Donnie, so everybody knows about Team Botcher. They're one of the best teams in the world. However, the last 3 years, they've been in the final. They haven't won. And you're the coach. Take us inside that conversation with these guys, Donnie, and your role as a coach and what you've been telling them and how you've been helping them.
Well, I'm there a lot for technical, which, of course, I learned from Jules over the years. I mean, best coach of all time, Jules Ochar. And they've been practicing a lot the last 2 months. They are ready. The first game was a little bit off, but, you know, that had to do with a little bit of rust. And first game in like 3 months, you can practice all you want, but until you get out and throw rocks on during a game, that's when it shows up. I had them practicing a lot of the hack board weight kind of shots because those are really important. I feel that the barrier to your big shots are your hack weight board weight shots and your runbacks. Those are your the money shots, I call them. They got to be chomping at the bit. I know I would be. I mean, we when I was playing with Kevin, we won our first barrier and then didn't win again till 97, 6 years later. So we came third, then second, then first in 97. So we did it the traditional way. You usually takes you a while to get your wins. And then when the wins come, it's a little easier for some reason.
Interesting question to ask you as a coach. And I know the role of the coach with a lot of these teams varies. So 2 years ago, 2019, you and I ran into each other in Kalamazoo, Michigan, as you were the coach of the Olympic gold medalist John Schuster. And now you're working with the Botcher team. What's the difference between working with Schuster and working with Botcher? Are you approaching things the same way or is it a little different role?
Pretty well the same, actually. I don't do as much technical with those guys. They have their own way of doing things, and I'm not even sure if they have their own coach, but I didn't do much technical with them. I do a lot of technical with Botcher's team, and took a few things from Schuster's team to teach the boys, like how to practicing both sides of the sheet, how to run it so you know you get as many rocks in as you can and better use your time and everything. It's a slow process being a coach. I mean, anybody can show up and coach, but to be a good one, there's so many things that you think you know and you don't. And I took a coaching course at the Saville Center to get my level to be able to coach. And there's so many things behind the game that you don't know about and how you can coach better. And it was a 2 days well spent, I thought.
Hey, Don, when it comes to the throwing two draws, one on each side of the sheet, we talked about this on our last podcast. We've talked about it in the Facebook group. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, because you guys, I think right now are currently in this briar number one on the draw to the button stat, which is a really important stat, in my opinion, a really important stat. Getting that hammer gives you an extra 6 to 7, maybe even 8 or 9% chance of winning each game. How do you handle it? Because we tried to talk about it last time, but of course, when you and I played, we didn't do it that way, a draw on each side. So can you kind of, I don't know, I don't want any secrets out of the bag, but what do you concentrate on in that practice to be able to do that?
So the first end, we just throw the rocks through, pick a spot all over the ice, edge of the 12, edge of the 8, edge of the 4, right down the middle. And we just fire hits to get the rocks to the other end. And then the two guys that are throwing the draw to the button, they'll each obviously throw the most draws. The other guys will throw a few to get draw weight. We've already got our rocks figured out before we get there. So it's a huge advantage to have the second practice, that's for sure. Because, you know, you're still breaking down the ice. So the first practice we did okay. But since then, we've got a lot better at breaking down the ice, making sure that all, if you're the first practice and you're a couple inches off your line, that could be 2-3 feet difference. So you really have to get the ice broken down well to be able to put it on the hole.
We've had a lot of comments on our Facebook page about this very factor in the last couple of days. Do you think this is the best approach that we're using right now, or could it maybe be changed?
No, it's not the best. It's the team who practices second has a huge advantage.
So how do we overcome that?
Go back to the old way. I mean, the old way was pretty good. I mean, we're doing this because of the Worlds, right? That's the reason why we're doing this in the Olympics.
To a degree, I think, yes.
And, you know, if you want to go forward with this, I think you have to have an advantage to the second team, whoever they're practicing, somehow give them the advantage. But then, of course, the team that's practicing first is not going to be very happy about that. So I think the fairest way is to have both teams shoot on both sides. So the first team practices with the intern and the second team practices with the outturn. That way it's fair for both teams. This way it's not fair for the team who practices first. I mean, you'll get better at it going forward, but right now the team who practices second has an advantage.
So with these 10-in games, are we throwing too many rocks?
Well, the last two or three games, actually, the ice has been really good. It's held up really well. The only thing you have to be careful, and I'm okay with this. Like, if you take, say, it's middle of the 12, and you throw a middle of the 12 and get to the button, fine. But if you have to start off edge of the 4 and throw a draw, or middle of the 8 to throw a draw, then it's a different time, because there's so many rocks thrown there throughout the game. The first half of the game is not so bad, but the second half, if you're in that area, you got to make sure you're adding a little extra weight. And I'm fine with that. It's very easy to have the ice all exactly the same from the edge of the 12 on both sides to the middle. I mean, that's, if you're throwing, 14 and a half, doesn't matter where you throw it in the ice, I don't think there's much talent to that. But if you have to change your weight a little bit and be aware of where you are, that takes more skill, I think.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, Donnie B. You know, you mentioned earlier, and I want to go back a little bit here, because you mentioned earlier how strong Newfoundland has become, especially with, well, Mark knows where they start with, and now Gushue going forward. But I think a lot of the reason that Brad is so good has to do with you bringing curling to the forefront with your Bonspiel. I really want to talk about that, the Don Bartlett Classic. I think, now once again, I'm going to pull out a year out of me, so I could be wrong again. But I think it started in 99. And what was the mayor's name? He was a super nice guy, the mayor of Gander at the time. But I just want to know what you think. Like, that was one of the best events on the tour for many years. But the results of you putting that Bonspiel on and how strong Newfoundland has got in curling.
Fred Rose is the guy who started it. It was my name. I didn't do a whole bunch with it. Fred is the guy and his committee. I mean, they did all the work getting all the teams there. I mean, it was the best spiel on tour, I thought, for about five. It ran for 8 years, and anybody who was anybody was there. You know, it was the second biggest purse on tour. It was $20,000 to win. Only the Slams had more money. Before it ran, all I said was, make sure we have the best rocks and the best ice maker. So they brought in Tim Yeo, and they brought in Kevin would know where the rocks came from. And I made sure that if we don't have that, I'm not going to do it. And then right away, Fred, okay, he looked into where we're going to get the rocks, and he brought Tim in, and great ice. Every year there, it was fantastic ice, fantastic conditions. And if you look at the winners, it's the who's who of curling, the 8 years that it ran.
So Fred Rose, of course, a great guy from, now he lives in Ontario, but from Gander, Newfoundland. So we needed really good rocks for the Grand Slam of curling, and we didn't have any rocks. And the West Winds Curling Club was shutting down in Calgary, and they had 10 sheets. And a group of guys from Northern Alberta actually bought all 10. And at that point, it was right before the boycott of the Brier back in the late 90s. So I was kind of enemy of the state. So I wanted to get five of those sheets, but of course they wouldn't sell them to me because obviously we're going to use them and they didn't want that. So I ended up talking to Fred Rose. I told him that I had heard from a little bird that they wanted about $40,000 or $45,000 for those five sheets of rocks. Okay. So I got a hold of Fred and said, listen, Fred, I'll give you the money. You got to phone the guys in Alberta and pretend you need them for your Bonspiel in Newfoundland. And if you can manage to get them, then you can have the rocks for the Don Bartlett Classic for as long as you run it for free. But we need to get those rocks for the Slams. So Fred, he's a character. So of course he phones up, I'm not going to say any names, but the guys in Northern Alberta. And of course he played the perfect part, got the rocks from them. We paid for them and they were fantastic insert stones in West Winds. So you're right, Donnie B., the best rocks you could possibly get. And you got Tim Yeo making the ice. So the ice was fantastic. And Fred Rose is sitting there with the best Bonspiel in Canada. That's a great setup.
And we didn't have any fun either. You know, it was the...
you know, it would have been better if Carter Rycroft wouldn't have been dancing so crazy and took out Kelly Law before the Olympics.
Yeah, that was another story. The very first Don Bartlett Classic, I was talking with Carter and Don shortly after, and they said their bedtimes for the first 3 days were 7, 7, and 6 a.m. and it surprised me, we never got the morning draw. I don't know how that worked, but we never had a morning draw.
Yeah.
So, Don, a question for you, as this is early in the week, maybe putting on the spot here, but you guys are going well. Who do you think might be the other couple teams that could be down to the final playoffs on Sunday?
Cooey's going really good right now. Never count out Guzzo, I'll tell you that. And Manitoba's doing really good. Gunner's playing really well. Like he has a different way of playing. I'll tell you, he knows the stats and everything. And he had a couple times to get a pretty easy deuce, you know, like a 90% chance of getting your deuce. And nope, not going to do it. I'm going to hit the corner guard and roll into the ring. Stuff like that. It just he wanted to be 100% sure he was scoring two when he had the hammer, and hopefully to do it in an even end. So he's all about stats, and they're playing really well right now.
I guess another team would be Saskatchewan. Dunston, this is, of course, Tuesday, but he had two big wins in his last two games, which I think would also suggest that he's right there.
Oh, yeah. There's 6, 7 teams, really. This is who's hot at the end. It's really tough. Like, we lost an early game, and we can't afford another loss, I don't think, going forward till the playoffs. It's this system is you've got to take as few losses as you can in the playoffs. One thing I'd like to see changed going forward, if it's possible, if we're going to keep with the 18 teams, is instead of going with 4 teams in each pool, go with 3 teams in each pool, because the fourth team almost has no chance. So why are you putting a team in that has no chance of getting to the next round? That's the one thing I'd like to see changed.
Donnie, in all the years, what's the big difference between the days you curled and the way that the teams curl now? What separates the good from the great in your mind? You know, the fitness thing, right? I know Kevin has mentioned this before, that it was like that was never around when we were there. Warren was the only guy for 40 years who was kind of into fitness. That's one of them. But what do you see there now, Don, between the days you played and what it takes now to be a team at a high level?
A lot of practicing, a lot of getting to the gym, that's for sure. The ice conditions are so much better now. Man, I was talking with Walchuk, and the sweeping. That's one of the biggest things is the sweeping now. Walchuk was saying that if he had the sweepers that the guys have now, you wouldn't miss a shot. They're so good, and the ice conditions are really good. I know the last 3 years I played with Kevin, he made us go to the gym. Wally and I, we hated it, but Kevin said, if you don't go to the gym, you're not on the team. So it was pretty clear. Wally and I would go and we'd go for an hour, not an hour and 2 minutes, 1 hour and done. And then Kevin, we'd see Kevin on the way. He'd be finished in his workout by the time we were walking in. And Kevin was there for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, working out with the Oilers, just dripping wet. And that definitely was not Wally and I. We were in shape, but we were in Kevin Martin shape, put it that way.
I got to tell a story here, Jimmy.
Yep.
So in the gym, so I'd be there and Don's bang on. I was there before. I'd be there and I'd be just leaving when Don and Don would show up. So Walchuk would show up usually just before Donnie B. And Donnie was a smoker. And so the guys would watch, the hockey players would go, they always got a kick out of it because Walchuk would be smoking and he'd have one last big drag before he went into the gym.
Boy, Donnie.
Going to the gym. And then, of course, they're expecting Donnie B. And I don't know if Donnie B. knows this, but his nickname at the gym was Red Alert. here comes Red Alert.
So, Walnut's kind of from another era, though. You can't pick on him.
Oh, it's fun to pick on Donnie. Oh, that's good.
Donnie, before we let you go, explain the bubble to us, how it works for you. We had Carrie Anderson on after, congratulations to her, after she won the Scotties, and we have an idea. Her story, by the way, is incredible. Go back and listen to the show about...
Yeah, I listened to it. It's a good story.
Yeah, how she almost didn't make it to the Spiel in Calgary. How is it for you? Explain to us sort of from the time you get up till the time you go back to bed, playing in the bubble.
Well, we get up in the morning, have breakfast, and then depending on what time you play. Like we've had the 1:30 draw a lot, so that's kind of nice. Just sit around and watch the morning game if you want. Don't do much. Just get ready for the time you have to leave. And then you got to check in. You do a twice daily check in to make sure you have no signs. Then you take your temperature. You scan on the way out. It's about a 2 or 3 minute drive to the arena. You scan as soon as you get there, and then you play your game, and then back to the hotel again. You don't do much. It's great. I mean, there's been no positive tests. We had our last one yesterday. I don't think there'll be any positive tests. So it works really well. Everybody's, you know, doing what they're supposed to. You can't congregate with the other teams. You got to stay in your own team. First few days, we had to stay in our own room. Couldn't even see your own teammates outside of your room. Now we can at least get together for team meetings and stuff in one room.
Do they put all your rooms together, like same floor and side by side, to kind of keep to the protocol of social distancing?
Yep. We have six rooms, and we're all on both sides of the hall all together. So we can actually have first couple of days we had opened up on our doors and we can at least talk to each other with our masks on. But you're used to it now. It's, you know, it's a bubble, and we knew this going in. Listen to the girls. We had girls who were telling us what was going on and everything, and the Scotties. So we knew going in, and it's a different year, but it's great that the guys get to curl. That's the great thing, and it's great that people across Canada get to watch, and across the world, actually. There's a lot of people in the States watch, too.
Mm-hmm. This is about halfway through the week in the Brier. Donnie, what are you telling the team that you're going to need going forward? Do you have to make any changes from the first few days to the last few days of the spiel?
No, they're pretty well where they want to be now. I mean, I think Botcher was 99 last game. Guys in the middle were 89, and Carrick was in the 80s. It's we can go a few points higher, but not much for Skippy. If Skippy keeps playing like that, I like our chances. He played this good last year too, so hopefully he can keep it up for one more game this year, and we'll see what happens.
What did you learn from Kevin all those years?
Just the dedication. I mean, nobody practiced more than Kevin did. Nobody went to the gym more than Kevin did. I didn't do half what Kevin did. You know, it's just he would throw 100, 150 rocks. I mean, I'd throw them there and back, and I thought I was good. And one thing I got from Kevin, too, is, you know, he pressed practice, guys. Come on, practice. You know, he could see that, you know, we have a spiel or two that we weren't at our best. And so I would go out on my own. I lived in Spruce Grove away from Edmonton. It's only a half-hour drive. But I would practice there a couple times extra. And, boy, I really noticed, wow, I'm making everything now. Just a little bit of extra practice. And anybody listening, like, if you have time and you want to be good, practice as much as you can. And the more you practice, the luckier you get. It seems the way it works.
What's your most memorable moment? Yeah, you've played as a high performance curler your whole life. You said you started at 13. When you look back, what's the biggest deal when you look back at your career?
Winning my first Purple Heart. I think that's why a lot of people aren't very happy with the situation that everybody is given a Purple Heart this year. It's not the curler's fault that there's a pandemic, and you know, if we're going to have this. There's two sides to the story, obviously. But, yeah, winning my first Purple Heart, winning my first Brier, playing in two Olympics. And one of my most cherished weekends was when we won the Continental Cup, the very first Continental Cup. It was just a great – we had six different teams, two from the States and four from Canada, ladies and men's. And it was so much fun. And you know, we were down the whole week. And we had a big surge on the last day to win it by a couple of points. And it was a week I'll never forget.
Kevin Warren, got anything else?
Well, I just want to appreciate Donnie taking the time, because I know you're super busy trying to get that Botcher team across the finish line. And Donnie B, hey, thanks a lot, buddy, for coming on the show.
Yeah, same for me, Don. Thank you for joining us, and good luck to you guys for the balance of the week.
I wanted more dirt. I wanted more dirt on Kevin, Don, but you stayed low-key.
Well, that'll be in the book. Coach tells all. It's Jules' title, but I might steal it if I write my book. And I'm a coach now, so I can do it.
Well, Donnie, good luck the rest of the way. Thanks a lot for taking the time, like Kevin said, to talk to us. And we really appreciate it. And, of course, Kevin and I are in Alberta. So we got a bias and are really pulling for you guys. So all the best, Donnie.
Thank you, guys. I enjoy your show.
What's up here, Donnie? You just came in my ear here when we were standing down. What do you mean you want to say something about me, Kevin and Warren? I'm scared.
So number one, I'll talk with you. I'll start with you, Jimmy.
Okay.
And you wouldn't know this, but, you know, when you're playing in the Briars, you need some downtime. There's a lot of pressure, and sometimes you're sitting in your room, and you know what? I need a good laugh, so I'm going to go to the Briar Patch.
Uh-oh.
I would go to the Briar Patch just to listen to you. You were that good, and you made me laugh, and I'll always appreciate that.
Well, I was drinking back then. Okay, those were the good ideas. Well, the patch was the spot, yeah, for sure. And I will have to say, one of the reasons it went so good over all the years in the Briar Patch is because the players, and I only see that from curlers compared to other athletes, are so accessible. So I'm sure I threw you on the screen when you were in there. So thank you. Thank you, Don. It was a riot.
And now next to Warren. Warren gets a lot of heat for his stuff that he does and everything on your inside curling thing. And, and you know, a lot of people don't understand how much Warren does. There's nobody, I don't think, in my lifetime that has done more for the game of curling than Warren Hansen. So I'm getting a little emotional here. On behalf of all the curlers, Warren, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and still trying to keep it going, so we can always do better, and that's my aim.
And finally, Mr. Martin, I had the best, I always said I had the best seat in the car for 16 years playing with you. And we had so much fun, and won so much, but the thing I'll take from it is the fun that we had. We had so much fun, and thank you for that, Kevin.
You bet.
Well, you got to love that guy, Kevin and Warren, Donnie Bartlett. Boy, I would have liked to hang with him in the days when he was curling in Gander, because they have no fun, Kev, when you go down east. But what a wonderful guy, and clearly he was choked up at the end. And so there's many sides to him, funny and passionate and absolutely skilled. But I was almost choking up myself, Kevin. What a great guy.
Yeah, Donnie B's he's one of a kind, Donnie B, I'll tell you. And he was all about having fun back in the day. He'd work hard, love to win, but the fun was the most important to Donnie B, and you could hear that in his voice. And yeah, true gentleman of the game, and obviously really an excellent coach as well, as being one of the top curlers that has ever played the game.
Warren, more guys like him are great for the game, aren't they?
Yeah, I've always loved the two Dons, Don Bartlett and Don Walchuk, and are two guys that I've been associated with over the years. And I always remember Don Bartlett from the 1992 Olympics. And of course, Kevin and his team were there curling as a demonstration sport for the second time over in Albertville. And I always remember Don Bartlett. He was just beside himself. He was so overjoyed to be there and be part of that whole thing. And that always really stood out with me.
You know, I've heard that a lot now about Walnut, Donnie Walchuk, and many stories about Don Bartlett. There used to be a great show, British show, called The Two Ronnies. Kev, can we do one called The Two Donnies and make a show out of it?
Should bring the two of them on together. That would be quite a show.
Okay, boys, that's a wrap on another show. Once again, we're very pleased that Sportsnet has stepped up and taken Inside Curling under their wing. The show's been growing exponentially and rapidly, and we wanted to get this to the masses, and certainly the best way we can do it is through Sportsnet. So thank you very much to them. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Warren. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Inside Curling.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jim.
No problem.